crusted salmon with lemon sauce, asparagus, and mashed potatoes at the Cheesecake Factory. Delicious. Now, let's go work it off. I just wanted to take a moment to thank those of you who share my videos, as I rely on word of mouth and have been censored on some social media platforms. I appreciate the support. Thank you. The California I grew up in has changed a lot recently, and while it still has its scenic beauty and great weather, I often wonder what archaeologists will think of it in the future, possibly after massive earthquakes, and what will they think of the people that inhabited the West Coast, and what will they conclude about the California lifestyle that is unique to this part of the world? It's a reminder of how fragile civilization is, and that unforeseen cataclysmic downturns, whether natural or man-made, could impact, alter, or end in a blink of an eye what many people today take for granted each day. The best example for this that we have in modern memory, anthropologically speaking, is the collapse of ancient Rome, which didn't necessarily happen overnight, as it was in decline for a number of years before succumbing to invading Germanic Aryan tribes. But in some cases, civilization did end abruptly, as was the case in Pompeii, an ancient city located in what is now near Naples, Italy, which was buried under 15 to 20 feet of volcanic ash during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. Pompeii is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and is one of the most popular tourist attractions in Italy, with approximately 2.5 million visitors annually. Largely preserved under the ash, the excavated city offered a unique snapshot of Roman life, frozen at the moment it was buried, and an extraordinarily detailed insight into the everyday life of its inhabitants, who were considered relatively wealthy, with many beautiful public buildings, luxurious private houses with lavish decorations, and works of art which left archaeologists stunned, so much so that museums refused to display the artifacts uncovered, almost all of which involved highly sexual situations. While Pompeii was known for luxury bathhouses and brothels, the sexual depictions were not restricted to these places, as even private homes and public restaurants were decorated with phallic symbols, which were not subtle at all, and in many cases not only featured the male member, but it was oftentimes adorned with bells and even with wings. I'm fully aware of how bizarre this must seem to modern eyes, but phallicism is an anthropological term applied to a form of nature worship in which adoration is paid to the generative function symbolized by the phallus, the male organ. It was common among many ancient tribes, particularly in the East, and had been prominent among the Phoenicians and the Greeks, both of whom had an influence on the ancient Romans, with the magical origins predating all of these civilizations. In its most elementary form, it's associated with orgiastic rites and to the joyous recognition of the principle of natural reproduction. The purely material and the symbolic aspects existed side by side. In ancient Greece, for example, phallicism was the essence of the dynastic worship and the Orphic mysteries that had, to the intellectual Greeks, a significance wholly different from that which they had to the common people. Phallic worship is especially interesting as a form of sympathetic magic, and these rites shocked Jewish writers in connection with the worship of Baal and Ashtaroth, or Ishtar. The same principle is at the root of the widespread nature worship of Asia Minor, whose chief deity, the great mother of the gods, is a personification of the earth's fertility. Similarly, in India, worship is paid to divine mothers. Keep in mind that phallic worship in the context of magic is often accompanied by androgynous symbology, such as a hermaphrodite, a word which is the combination of the god Hermes and Aphrodite. In the dynastic rites, the emblem was carried at the head of the procession and was immediately followed by a body of men dressed as women. In Rome, the phallus was the most common amulet worn by children, who were also very much included. Similar rites can be found in ancient India, as well as both hemispheres of the Americas, where magic was also practiced. Now, when I say magic, I'm referring specifically to the word spelled with a K, coined by occultist Aleister Crowley, who at one point was the head of the OTO, an organization known for practicing ancient sex rituals and whose seventh degree of initiation involves, quote, adoration of the phallus as Baphomet, both within and without. The term Baphomet implies the coming together of the male and female polarity, and even the number seven, as I've discussed in a prior video, represents the same, as the number three symbolizes the male and four symbolizes the female. So seven is alchemically understood as the unified perfection of this creative or generative sex energy, as attested to by the G in Freemasonry, which is the seventh letter of the alphabet. The structure of the Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO, like that of Freemasonry, is based on a stage series of initiations, or degrees, and the essence of the order is in its higher degrees, which go up to 12, and they're based on ancient sex magic practices that go back into prehistory and are far too graphic to describe in this presentation. That said, I will say that the goal of this sort of magic is not only to induce synchronicity and influence the material world through focused and amplified intent, but to achieve this through creating an astral entity, an etheric child, so to speak, which, according to Crowley, quote, is a bodiless creation of a holy divine nature. I don't want to get too detailed about the occult or esoteric practices involved with phallic worship, but only wanted to give some insight as I came across an interesting presentation on Pompeii and some of the artifacts that were found there and locked away in museums behind closed doors, as they were regarded as too sinful for a Christian audience.
All right, so buckle up, we're going to go to Pompeii. Okay. So you may not know. The Victorians were great admirers of the ancient Romans. They felt they were their spiritual and cultural parents. And the Roman culture was a rich and pervasive influence. There was a wealth of plundered artifacts in the museums that you could go check out. You learned Latin as part of your Victorian education. And the values of decorum and respectability came from the Roman ideals of dignitas and honestas. This painting of Faithful Unto Death, yes, you can sort of see it's a little dark, by Sir Edward John Poynter, was created in 1865, about 2 years after that statue of Augustus Caesar was dug up. So you can see they're really taking this stuff in. And it shows a Roman guard standing at his post, even as Vesuvius is exploding and burying everybody around him in ashes. It was a beloved image in England. It showed an individual sacrificing himself for the betterment, in the line of duty. And this was proper conduct. They could relate to this. The Roman philosophy of Stoicism to the English was a form of keeping a stiff upper lip. So this love affair with all things Greco-Roman was going on really nicely until they started pulling things out of the ashes of Pompeii. Digging up ruins and finding fantastic treasures was a really great way for a king to make a real name for himself. And so in 1819, King Charles of Bourbon III, his Prussian wife and young daughter were visiting the excavations in Pompeii, flouncing about and picnicking while they waited to be dazzled by the antiquities that were being pulled up out of the ground. In her book, Pompeii Awakened, A Story of Rediscovery, author Judith Harris relates what happened next. Amidst a flotilla of courtiers in silk and befurred velvet finery, Charles and his Prussian wife, Queen Maria Amalia, arrived in rustling stately procession and took their seats on folding chairs. From the bowels of the earth, the carved white marble group, two embracing figures appeared at the mouth of the tunnel, borne upon a litter carried by prison laborers. A shiver of excitement rippled through the court. Already, the dainty turn of that horn revealed the prized Greek look. When the whole sculpture group hoved into view, two heads could be seen and two bodies. One seemed to be a man of sorts, though at closer look he wore two small horns on his head. He gazed fondly into the female's languid marble eyes, for locked in his embrace was a female goat. Surely the prettiest of the flock, whom he was in the act of penetrating. This is actually King Charles. I think he looks like one of those proboscis monkeys. The director of the British School of Rome, Andrew Wallace Hadrill, explained, "Normally with a statue, the bits that you can't easily see are only roughed out, but with this you find that the genitals of both Pan and the nanny goat are fully present and visible. You can't ever get an uninterrupted view." In horror and embarrassment, Charles put a ban on any further excavations at Pompeii. They just sealed it right back up. For real. That obviously didn't last, though they were on hold for a bit during the French Revolution. Pompeii is massive. Today we've only uncovered about two-thirds of it, but at the time a succession of Bourbon kings kind of kept at it. And by 1837 the excavation was in full swing, as well as the general panic about the kind of objects that they kept pulling out of the ground. Like this. Early excavators at first decided that everything that had a sexy mural on it had to either be a brothel or a sex club. They later found out that some of these rooms that were like the cook's quarters and stuff had a sexy mural because that's what the cook liked to look at. And at the time, they were finding this, like, well, that's a sex club, and that's a sex club. This led to a lot of mislabeling of just about every single building in Pompeii.
Is that a tentacle in the upper right?
I can't figure out what that is. I thought the same thing too, right? Like, there's something kind of funny going on there. We don't really know. So anyway, they eventually identified the brothels by transcribing the graffiti that was written in Latin on the walls. So for example, some of them, this is real, said, "Theophilus, don't perform oral sex on girls against the city wall like a dog." Or, "Restituta, take off your tunic, please, and show us your hairy privates." This, however, presented a whole new problem, because if the Lupinar, or Wolf's Den, was the brothel, then what was all this sexy stuff doing in every other building in town? There were mosaics and statuary and frescoes and ceramics, many of which were of Priapus, the son of Aphrodite and Dionysus, god of fertility and growth. We get the word priapism for an erection that just lasts forever from him for very obvious reasons. It was common to have a statue of Priapus in your house, really common to have him in your garden. He was a protector of your from thieves and also good for growing plants. And often they would be inscribed with little signs like, "If I do seize you, you shall be so stretched that you will think your anus never had any wrinkles." Right? Look out. So protective penises were carved into paving stones. They were hung over doorways. They were carved out of street corners and shop walls. They poked out in wind chimes and oil lamps. They brought you good luck. They had wings. They had bells. They had feet. Sometimes they had wings and bells and legs. This is a fascinus. This warded off the evil eye. Very handy. There were gorgeous murals in the Villa of the Mysteries that depicted a young woman being initiated into Greco-Roman mystery cult or maybe being prepared for marriage. They don't know. Over in the bathhouse, they found more erotic frescoes. And at the time, they thought, well, these are obviously advertisements for prostitution and stuff that you could have done at the bathhouse. They don't think that anymore. Now they think that they were markers for the cubby where you put your clothes. So this is how you would remember where you left your toga and sandals. Over by the three-way, right? Easy. And maybe this is where you left your chicken. So most of Europe compared itself to the Greco-Roman Empire, and these discoveries were a huge culture shock. But for the Victorians, it was a threat. And as the classical Simon Goldhill explained, it was very important for the Victorians that the ancient world, both Greek and Roman, was full of clean, white statues that they could respond to as purity, beauty, and sublimity. These new revelations about their cultural forebears did not mesh with this idealized prudery. It was as if they'd walked in on their parents having sex, a lot of sex, with everything. So the Duke of Calabria, Francis I, said, "All these obscene objects are going to be locked away in the Gabinetto degli Oggetti Osceni, the Cabinet of Obscene Objects, or Secret Museum," which was under the Museo Borbonico in Naples. And they actually bricked over the door in 1849 just to, like, really put it away. So, there. Was Pompeii extra pervy? I mean, not really. It was a luxury resort town, but it's likely that most of the Roman Empire kind of was hung with penises and erotic murals at the time, and then a succession of more, you know, uptight rulers, and eventually Christianity came in and sort of swept through and cleaned everything up. They just got buried under about 20 feet of ash before they had a chance to redecorate. So, the Victorians disappeared all the erotic art, right? Trying to make contemporary Western civilization into, like, the see no evil monkey. And what could be moved was hauled away and sealed up in the secret museum. What they couldn't carry off, they put behind huge locked metal gates, and you couldn't see any stuff. They even plastered over some of the murals, and we didn't find them until 1989 when rain started washing some of the plaster off. Crazy. So all this forbidden art, locked away in Lockheed, only accessible to people of mature age and respected morals. Rich white men. Women were not allowed to view any of this stuff at all. We were too corruptible. But why all the fuss? The Victorians believed that if people were exposed to obscene images, it would inevitably lead to sexual excitement and worse, masturbation. Something they believed was totally addictive. So art historian Alison Smith said the ultimate fear was that loosing this sacred seed, men would become enfeebled, feminized, and degenerate. And these corrupted individuals would then go on to corrupt the entire society. So these artifacts from Pompeii were seen as proof that what had actually caused the fall of the Roman Empire was masturbation. So catalogers and archaeologists tasked themselves with devising a new taxonomy to wrangle all these priceless obscenities, and all the art that was squirreled away in the secret museum was called pornography, which was coined by a German art historian, C.O. Mueller. And in 1864, the Webster's Dictionary, the first time this word ever appeared, like, in print in the Webster's Dictionary, they defined it as licentious painting employed to decorate the walls of rooms sacred to bacchanal and orgies, examples of which exist in Pompeii. So since they knew it was impossible to regulate becoming sexually excited, they would criminalize the images that might trigger those feelings instead and create the concept of pornography, which allowed the Victorians to do to ideas what they had already done with the art. In 1857, Lord Chief Justice Campbell addressed the House of Lords and said sexual images were a poison more deadly than prussic acid, strychnine, or arsenic. He produced the Obscene Publications Act, and suddenly there were harsh penalties for anybody who had naughty pictures. And in an act of pure idiocy, they prosecuted social reformer Annie Besant, who produced a manual on birth control for the working class. Go figure. And that Pan statue stayed locked up in the obscene museum until the year 2000. Yeah. Today it'd be hard to shock any of us, thanks internet. But science, thank you, is showing us something new about classical sculpture. It was gaudier than your grandma's garden gnome. For hundreds of years, multiple cultures revered this idea of this sort of stoic, white, classical look, and that's not what they were about at all. They were supposed to embody this quiet, noble simplicity, and they didn't want anything to do with quiet or simple. The Greeks and Romans thought that marble without a coating of paint was hideous. So this quote from Helen of Troy by Euripides makes a little more sense. If only I could shed my beauty and assume an ugly aspect the way you would wipe color off a statue. It turns out that the Greek and Romans' idea of keeping it classy was really different both in content and appearance from what we've been thinking for hundreds of years. And if you're interested in this color stuff, there's actually a show about it at the Legion of Honor up till January called Gods in Polychromy.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below, and I hope to see you again soon.